Blog Talk Radio.
Friends, you're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you can find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog, blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about emerging technologies and emerging possibilities. We talk about what's happening in the world today and where we think that's going. To make it brief, we talk about the future, and we take a very casual view about the future on this program. We believe that if you're not excited about the future, maybe you're not paying as close attention as you should. We believe that something is going to happen, something wonderful. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you doing, man?
I am super fantastic. How are you?
I'm awesome. Doing good.
I got a great story about being super fantastic. I went in to talk to a colleague in the Boulder on Friday, and she asked me how I was, and I said, I'm super fantastic. And she goes, you don't look it. She said, you look pretty tired. She said, I'm going to say you look at best about, moderately fantastic. So.
What a bring down, huh?
Yeah. We had a long discussion about all the, you know, slightly fantastic up to, excessively fantastic. You know, there's a lot of different ways you can be, but I try to keep the dial set right at
super fantastic.
But, I was caught out, so I'm trying to be careful. Trying to be careful with that. So, how's your weekend been? Anything interesting going on?
Not a whole lot interesting. We painted the main room in our house, and that was very productive, but not a whole lot of fun. Took the kids to see Witch Mountain, Race to Witch Mountain on Friday. That was a good kids movie. I enjoyed it.
Now, is it a remake of the original Escape to Witch Mountain, or just really the same title, or do you know?
It's I didn't really watch Race to Witch Mountain as a kid. I don't know how close to the original plot it was, but I suspect it's only in broad outline is it like the original. Okay, I thought it was cool they had cameos from the original kids that showed up in this movie. Obviously,
oh, that's cool.
They're not kids anymore, but they were both. The boy and the girl were there, and maybe the original Winnebago had a cameo. So
that would be awesome. Yeah.
But,
I believe in the original that Winnebago actually takes flight at some point using late 70s special effects. So that,
yeah, maybe it was a blue screen, but I don't know if they even went that far.
Yeah, I don't know. No, maybe a miniature. I'm not sure. Yeah, I actually heard a review of. Race to Witch Mountain Friday. I was listening. I was driving home from Boulder, and I had the radio on, and I was if you ever listen to the Hugh Hewitt show, which I, sometimes catch a little of it, but Friday afternoons, his last hour is about movies every week. And he has this guy, Emmett, the Unblinking Eye is the guy's name, who does movie reviews on that show. And he was talking about Race to Witch Mountain, and the question was, did you like it? Was it a good movie? He's like, yeah, it was a good movie. Now, nothing any character in the movie does makes a lick of sense, but if you're okay with that, it's a pretty good movie. So,
yeah, it's a kids movie. You don't go into it expecting it's not great. It's just good, and it's good fun. And Dwayne Johnson, better known to many as The Rock. He's got charisma like, nobody else. And he can carry a movie all by himself if he wants to, it seems to me. And he kind of did. But it was a good movie. I enjoyed it. And, certainly the kids did. So, if you got kids, drag them to the movie. They'll have a good time.
Okay, so we're getting a thumbs up on the Race to Witch Mountain. We've also got our chat host Michael Darling with us. Michael, how are you?
Good evening, gentlemen. I'm also super fantastic.
Oh, glad to hear that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'll tolerate no others trying to define that for me. I self-identify on that one.
Fair enough. But it's got to be credible. That's all I'm saying. You know, if you say it, people have to believe that you're feeling it.
Sell that deal.
And I'm getting the vibe. Okay, I'm getting a definite vibe from Michael right now. So we've got a really fun show this evening. Just to catch everyone up. What's been going on the last 2 weeks leading up to this evening. We took 2 weeks and we went through a list of breakthrough business ideas from the Harp Business Review. They had 20 of these ideas, and we went through 10 of them last week, and then we went through, or excuse me, 10 of them the week before last, and then 10 of them last week. And we said, now this week we're going to see if we can top those Harvard Business Review breakthrough ideas with breakthroughs of our own. So that's our theme for this evening. But before we get into our list of our personal breakthroughs, I've got kind of a breakthrough science story that I'd like to share. So I think, Stephen, it would not be inappropriate for us to delve into the world of science, into the world of the known, in a little feature that we like to call
Astounding Science Facts.
We've got to do this more often. I don't know why we don't do this more often. I always get such a charge out of that. My own voice when modified really excites me. Okay, so here's the story in a nutshell as I summed it up on The Speculist. And I said there that I wasn't sure how to classify this, but I should have realized that the way to classify this is it's an astounding science fact. But bottom line is, a man injured in an accident, spent 20 years in a wheelchair, was paraplegic, more bad luck comes his way. He's bitten by a poisonous spider and subsequently regained the ability to walk. That's the story.
You know, I just love that. Here's this guy, you know, and he's thinking, you know, I'm sure he wouldn't, you know, self-pitying quite this bad, but here he is. I'm in a wheelchair, and then, you know, as if that's not enough, and then wham, you know, Black Widow, you know, bites me on my keister, and now, you know, and then, you know, over the coming days, he develops the ability to walk again. Now, do we know exactly why he was in the wheelchair? What was wrong with him that he couldn't walk, that got fixed apparently by a spider bite?
It was a motorcycle accident. Ended up in his paralysis. What the exact nature of the injury was, it didn't say, but you assume, you know, it's a spinal injury. If someone's paralyzed from the waist down. Although I don't think the article that I linked to said there is, I think there's a link to a video clip there that might have more details. And I actually haven't watched the video yet. I've only read the story, but it's just bizarre to think that, actually it was not a black, we should be scientifically accurate here. It was a brown recluse.
Okay. Okay.
And those are very dangerous. My brother was bitten by one of those a while back and had to go to the hospital, had to be treated for that. They are, no laughing matter. So he's bit. He gets taken to the hospital, and a nurse notices that his leg is beginning to spasm. And as they're running some tests on him, his legs begin to show some movement. They discover, you know, that his nerves, as it says here, the nurse says, your nerves are alive. They're just asleep. And 5 days later, this man who had not walked in 20 years, 20 years to walk. So,
you know, here's the question I have. Can he sense danger before it happens, and can he climb walls now? I mean, you know.
Well, one of the two places I saw this story, once one before posting it and one after posting it. I saw it initially on Twitter. I think it was Jim Elvidge put it up on Twitter, our friend from The Universe Solved. But then I saw on Facebook Mike Treader also linked to it, and it was the same basic story, a paralyzed man able to walk again after being bit by a spider, and I saw somebody else left the comment, was it a radioactive spider?
Yeah.
So, yeah, same
I'm not the only one who thought that, huh? Okay.
No, I guess, or unless you're the one who left that comment, no, I think somebody else had the same idea. But it's you know, it is almost like out of a comic book. I mean, he didn't gain superpowers by being bitten by a spider, but ask him if he cares, right? I mean, he didn't think he was going to ever have again. You have to think that they're singing in the spider's venom that threw a switch that got those nerves working again. And we can only hope that that's going to open up that will lead to medical breakthroughs in their own right of just the possibilities there are staggering when you think about it. It's like, well, is it really possible that people paralyzed can get a little bit of poison in their body and begin to walk again? Obviously, there's a whole lot of work that has to be done first, and this is an anomalous case, and there could be any number of factors involved. But still, the hope that it provides is a tremendous thing, and it's just a great story, great encouraging story.
Well, you know, Sally in the chat room, called it a miracle. And it is. But I'm kind of like you in this, Phil. I don't want the one-time miracle. I want the, I want them to be able to study what happened here and make it a ho-hum, everyday, mundane kind of thing, where they can treat everybody with what they learn out of it from this. That's remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I'll let it be a miracle that the right spider showed up at the right time to bite the right guy, that we could suddenly make this discovery. And then if we can repeat the results, that's the best case. So that's our one-off Astounding Science Facts for this evening, and we will pick it up again sometime in the very near future, because I always miss this when we don't do it. So we'll pick it up again in the future on another edition of.
Okay.
Astounding Science Facts.
Now, I'm just going to have to ask everyone to just give us a moment here, okay? I have to talk to Stephen. Stephen, you knew it was coming, right? I mean,
yes, I knew it was coming, but I was still sitting there soaking in the coolness of the guy getting by.
Oh, okay. You were so captive by the material that. Okay. That's okay. You know what? I'll totally buy that. That's good. Okay. I like it. Well, this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're getting ready to work through a list of breakthrough ideas. We've got a few suggestions for breakthroughs of our own that apply to the business world or to the world in general. And if you've got your own breakthrough ideas, please share them with them if you're listening live on our live chat, or drop a comment at blog.speculist.com. All right. So I'm going to start with one of two breakthrough ideas that I blogged about this week. And the first of the two is something that I picked up on Future Pundit. And Future Pundit reported a really interesting story about a beta blocker called propranolol, which permanently reduces the human fear response. Very interesting research where they will take a subject. They will expose them to a frightening image. They will subject them to pain at the same time that they're seeing it. So you get a very strong net response established for a particular image, such that if you show them that image, there's an immediate spike in the fear response in their brain until you give them a dose of this this beta blocker, propranolol, and boom, it goes away. The fear response is eliminated. Now, Randall had a number of thoughts as to how something like this might be applied. He talked about in terms of what effect this might have on the political process. I ran with that a little bit. I think it would be great. I think if we removed fear from our political discourse, No, I take that back. There's always going to be a certain amount of fear in our political leaders. If we removed fear, kind of a visceral fear response, a fear of the other kind of response from how we view people on the side of political issues, I think that would be tremendously helpful. I think you get that fear out of how we deal with other people. I really liked I liked Randall's take that it would have a big impact on the potentially on the political process. And there were some other ideas that I threw out there. Talked about it would be a nice thing for terminal patients, people who are dealing with know that their death is imminent, who are dealing with a lot of fear related to that, or even maybe their families, their loved ones who are dealing with a lot of fear related to that, if they so chose and wanted to remove the fear from the process, that would be an option for them. And then you look at there's some other categories where it's not as clear. You take athletes, take away the fear of pain from an athlete, take away the fear of danger from a firefighter
or
from
soldier.
A soldier.
Yeah.
Yeah. Then you've got a situation where, yes, these could probably become tremendously more effective than they already are at doing what they do, but at the cost of probably their own lives. Athletes, maybe not their lives, but just they might run out their career a lot faster. They might just destroy themselves within a couple of seasons. But yeah, police officers, EMTs, firefighters. I think there would all be this risk of if you push fear completely out of the equation. Are they helped by that? There might be a case to be made that society would be helped by that, but I'm not sure that those individuals would be helped by that. And I haven't thought about that though, Phil.
I mean, think about it this way. Okay. Let's say that I'm the only one in my platoon in war that's been given this treatment. Okay, I would think that I'd be the guy that would end up getting himself shot probably faster than anybody else. I'd be one of the first to go down, right? But what if my entire platoon had been given the same treatment? We might be one of the most effective, cohesive units in the theater. I mean, just because you work together as a team, and you're not fear has been taken out of it. Maybe, I don't know. Just a thought.
Yeah, it could be. It could be. Although you might also be the team that does one extremely glorious thing and then goes down in a blaze of glory because you're all fearless.
Yeah, they end up naming memorials after you because you're so awesome, but you're gone. So yeah, I
exactly.
That's true.
Yeah, you get the high school football stadium named after again. It's at a substantially high cost. Although it is a cost that people in that line of work are prepared to face.
It need to be voluntary. You wouldn't give soldiers this without letting them know what you're doing to them.
Well, one of the things that I thought was interesting was Harvey talked about how this might be a cure for all of humanity's ills if we could. I think he was talking specifically about removing the fear of the other. But one of the things I got to thinking about, if somebody was doing social engineering, and if you wanted to fix the economy in fair short order, would it make a big difference if suddenly tomorrow morning everybody had fear inhibitor put in their drinking water and we all took a drink of water and by tomorrow afternoon none of us were afraid of what was going to happen with the economy anymore? Would that push us over the edge into unbelievably risky territory, or would suddenly people, because they were less afraid, they'd start taking out credit and the economy would be saved? I don't know.
It's hard to say. I happen to know that high blood pressure medicine that's based on the beta blocker technique allows people to stand up in front of crowds and do public speaking a lot easier. The fear of public speaking is dampened by beta blockers. So apparently this is also another beta blocker that has a different fear effect.
And that was the final example that I gave, was to eliminate social fear and anxiety. Take away this fear of rejection. Take away this fear of looking ridiculous. And people would be a lot more bold in what they would be willing to take on. They'd be a lot more bold in what they'd be willing to try. And one of our commenters, Jeff, actually went to some lengths to talk about what a big difference this would make in his life and what a big difference it would make in everyone's life if we were able to just overcome those fears. And certainly anytime you see anyone who accomplishes any great thing, they have overcome some level of fear, almost certainly, that they have taken what they're most afraid of and put that away. You know, it's not like they're not afraid anymore necessarily, but they have compartmentalized it, or they've pushed it to one side to the extent that they're able to go on and achieve new things. So that one, it looks to me like you think, yeah, public speaking, or you think how much more effective somebody who's in, say, sales might become if they're not afraid of the rejection that naturally accompanies that kind of a job. It seems to me that that would be tremendously huge. But even there, I think there's a risk, because a world in which all of our social inhibitions have been removed might not be the most fun and pleasant world to live in, right? There's a real risk that people would become kind of pushy, or that we would feel they were being pushy, that they were being obnoxious. And I don't know. Yeah. As I look at this, it seems to me there are huge benefits, and I think there are almost certainly big benefits for us as a species to overcome these fears. I'm not sure if we need drugs to do it. I guess that's kind of where I end up. I'm like, you know what? I want us to conquer our fears non-chemically, I think is where I end. Except for these limited cases where I think it really would be helpful. Oh, and the other example I was going to give that occurred to me, people like flight attendants. You know, there are people who work as flight attendants who are terrified of flying.
Yeah.
There's no point being afraid of flying if you're a flight attendant. If you could take a pill and have that fear gone, it seems like their lives would just be a lot.
You would think that it's like the having a fear of blood and working as a surgeon. That'd be a tough one to you'd think you'd find something else to do. But anyway.
What you would think, yeah. Although what's interesting about that is apparently that's something that people can develop over time, which for most of us that flies exactly in the opposite of what we experience. Most people, if you've never flown, you're a little bit nervous about it, or you might be way scared of it. But even if you're a pretty nervous flyer, the more you fly generally, the more immune you become to the whole experience. Apparently some people who fly a lot suddenly become very much afraid of the process. Along the way. Well, I would throw that over to Michael, actually. You, in the Air Force, did you encounter people who, after flying for a long time, became afraid of the process of flying? Was that ever something that came up?
I'll give you the straight answer, because that's what you're looking for. There's all sorts of punchlines I could throw out at the expense of my former crewmates. No, I never saw anybody go from being competent, capable, focused, and up to a degree comfortable in an airplane that then developed later an irrational fear of it. Although I will say, I have known people who, the more they understood aviation in general, got to be pretty darn scared of it. Like, oh, how many moving pieces have to work just right for this thing to stay afloat? And
right.
Then they got a little bit more nervous. But I think that's a different phenomenon.
Yeah, could be. Well, and I think flight attendants might be especially vulnerable just because they do get to see more of how the sausage is made maybe than people want to, and they have no control whatsoever, right? They're always along for the ride, so maybe that's a syndrome particularly to them. But anybody who has a pathological fear related to something that no matter what they're going to have to deal with every day, it seems like that would probably be a good patient.
I love this thing Sally's got in the chat room. So that scene in Top Gun, that was fake. Well, I'm guessing it must have been.
You got to refresh my memory on the scene in Top Gun.
Okay, it's at the very beginning of Top Gun. Okay, this guy, he's kind of the red shirt,
Cougar.
What's that?
Cougar.
Cougar. Okay.
Cougar.
Cougar gets all screwed up because he's thinking apparently too much about his fiance back home and all this, and a MiG gets on his tail. Okay, he gets all screwed up, and then they manage to get out of there without there's no shots fired or anything, and so he goes and he tries to land on the carrier, and he has some trouble.
And so Maverick and Goose get that, they go inverted head-to-head with the MiG, and he takes the Polaroid of the guy from, like, 8 inches away. And then they catch up to Cougar, and Cougar's freaking out. And Maverick gives one of the great, you know, aviator movie lines of all time, where he floats up next to him in formation and goes, "Hey, anybody seen a boat around here?"
Anybody seen it?
It's all coming back to me now. Okay, yeah, so... But see, that's the thing Sally needs to understand is we're talking naval aviators, not Air Force pilots. So, Michael, if he was going to give one of his glib answers, he might well have taken a shot at their expense and chose not to, which is
I try not to make fun of Top Gun.
Yeah, well, you know, that's probably a safe move, actually. I think you'll live longer not doing that. Okay, well, let's move quickly on. What's our next breakthrough idea? And, Mike, since I believe you've got a couple for us, why don't you give us one now?
Okay, and I'm going to apologize in advance if I fumble with the, you know, the nice, short, concise, even clippy, you know, soundbite. But let me say this. Both in the list we looked at the last 2 weeks and in the world at large, people talk a lot about applications like Facebook and Twitter and, in general, the social networking or group thinking or crowd computing or whatever you want to call it, this ability to... connect interpersonally and socially around the world. And the breakthrough, I think, is this, and you got to stick with me for a minute, because the bar we set for our breakthroughs was that it be either something new or a fresh look at something in a sense that makes it a breakthrough. And my breakthrough is the United States Declaration of Independence and Constitution. And here's my thinking. From that point forward, mostly as a group of people, but, you know, you could say as a nation, we redefined how we were going to organize and how we were going to interact with each other, both to promote an independent country, but also it turns out to be really good at promoting things like development, whether it be social or personal, and innovation and entrepreneurship and all that kind of stuff basically led the way to the internet and Facebook and all the social and other networking and that we have, without which I'm not so sure we'd have it. I'm not so sure that kind of connection capability or connectivity was going to happen in, and I'm going to try and pick something from the 18th century. I'm not sure it was going to happen in a monarchy run by Mad King George, or any other social organization of the era, let alone any of the other social organizations of the intervening 240 years that haven't worked out so well.
I like it. I like it. There's a brand new book out called The 5,000-Year Leap, and the author's whole thesis is basically we've come 5,000 years in the last 200 or 300 years. Based on the technology that the people had when they came to the New World, you know, was not fundamentally different from what they had 5,000 years before, you know, and you can see how far we've come since then. So,
and I think it's
our system is a big part of the reason why.
Yeah, well, if you look at these precursors to the singularity, you look at the precursors to the big changes, the something wonderful that we talk about that can happen, that we hope to live to see. The one we often talk about is the Industrial Revolution. That's the closest one in time that is similar in terms of scope, and it kind of, you know, there's this direct line from it to where we are. But Michael, you're absolutely right. This is when you look at the Declaration of Independence in particular, and that's a document that I've actually taken and revised for the when I wrote my Declaration of Singularity a few years back. Same kind of idea, that this is an absolute reset of the order of how humanity is organized. Something that starts with the proposition of individuals and their value and their rights and how they, you know, become a nation, how a nation is drawn out of a group of individuals who all have rights, rather than the idea that, you know, the nation already exists and there's this hierarchy and there's these power structures that make. So I can absolutely see that. If you draw a straight line, and you absolutely can, from say the invention of the something like the printing press, or maybe the first automated printing press, to the internet, yeah, you can draw a straight line from the Declaration of Independence to social networks, to people having their own website. It's almost like we've found this other substrate in which to try to go after life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Would we have ever been able to do that? Would we have ever been able to do it in that substrate had those events not occurred in the original substrate? I'm thinking you're right. I don't see how that could have happened.
Well, the Industrial Revolution took off here first, you know. And of course, then it was transplanted worldwide after that, or in places where it could be transplanted, it went. But
and it didn't have to take off here first.
Yeah.
The manufacturing base that existed in England and in Western Europe at the time and in other parts of the world certainly was conducive. I'd argue they weren't organized for it. The innovation that it took for it to take off here just wasn't going to happen anywhere else.
Yeah, it was our freedom that allowed it to take off. And that's, yeah, I can see that.
Yep, innovate or die, and we do it.
Yep.
And, you know, that's really good, because there was such an emphasis in the list that we went through on social networks. It seemed like social networking came up about every second or every third item on that list. So the whole notion of social networking is huge in the minds of these scholars, these folks who are looking at patterns, looking at trends, looking at what's happening, and looking at where things are going. And I think it's great to step back and look at where that trend actually originates. You might have a winner. If we were going to do a prize winner for the breakthrough, Michael, we might be looking at you. Anyway, you're in the lead. I'm going to give you the advantage over.
Well, just in case there's a choice to be made, my choice is going to be freaking huge.
Well, no, as of course, as an employee of Speculous Media, you can't win a prize. You know, that's. The guy who talks fast at the end of the ads was that, right? Employees of Speculative Media, not eligible for prizes, something like that. But in our hearts, you will have won that. Okay, so this is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. We're working through our own list of breakthrough ideas, and if you've got a breakthrough you'd like to share and you're listening to us live, please share it in our online live chat or leave a comment for us at blog.speculus.com. Okay, Stephen, what's next? You got a big breakthrough for us, I'm thinking.
Yeah, and this one's huge. And the reason I think it's huge is because it could bring about what Brian Wong calls the mundane singularity, and it could happen as soon as this year, okay?
Okay, so first you're going to have to step back and very quickly, 25 words or less, catch everybody up on the mundane singularity.
Okay, mundane singularity is a singularity that occurs. Okay, I guess I should first define the singularity. Singularity happens when greater than human intelligence arrives. And what happens after that? Well, we can't really say much about what happens after that, because we're not smart enough to know what people that are smarter than us would do. And so that's the technological singularity, okay? Brian Wong had the idea, well, you know, what if, you know, we never develop AI? You know, it turns out that advanced general intelligence is just practically impossible, and or this happens or that happens, and we just never quite make it. You know, we could still have a pretty bright future, and he listed out about, you know, a half dozen, maybe a dozen ways that we could have a mundane singularity, a singularity that's pretty cool, that takes us to a whole nother level, but doesn't quite get us to, you know, the true blue technological singularity. The technology that we're talking about, Tobias Buckow called lamina technology. And Phil, you want to explain to our audience what, you know, why he called it lamina technology?
Actually, I'm not 100% sure why he called it, except I'm going to guess that it's like a paint, it's like a laminate, it's like a covering that's been put over the real world, over meat space, that you're getting at the same time. So if you think about the real world is just sitting there, the lamina becomes this other layer that you're getting on top of that, and that's going to be data that you're seeing, or an enhanced visual view of the world that you're seeing, or whatever it is that's being fed to you. It's kind of the next layer of reality.
Okay, so at the last TED Talk, a lady by the name of Patty Mays got up and talked about what we're calling lamina technology. They had developed, and this was just off-the-shelf stuff, okay? They didn't have to invent anything new. They put together about $350 worth of gadgets, and, you know, it's kind of clumsy, and it hadn't been engineered together, but what it amounted to was a projector on the chest of somebody. Looked a little bit like it'd be a little bit like Iron Man, huh? But it was a projector on the chest, and it was connected to the cell phone by Bluetooth, and it also had, there was a camera involved, and this and that. But through various gestures, you could like it would project onto, you know, you open a book, it would recognize the book, and it would project a review from perhaps Amazon onto the book, so you could sit there and read it. You know, you could walk through the supermarket and it would instantly, project up on the aisle, what's the best product to buy based on the criteria that you had put in. And, you know, on and on. Even you could walk up to somebody and it would project on them information about this person. Now, the first thing in this technology that had to go is the projector, you know.
Right.
And for one thing, the projector takes up a huge amount of energy, you know, to project something where you can see it in a bright room or out in the in the outdoors in the daytime. Just a huge amount of energy would be involved. Plus, everybody in the world would see, what you're projecting on something, including if you were projecting.
Right.
Go ahead.
If you're getting that. Things of this person from social network, look at him. You look at, is this a nice person? Is this a total jerk? And it turns out they're a total jerk. Well, you don't want to project, just know that and move on. And the whole advantage of the lamina is kind of lost if it's all out into the real world.
Hey, Phil, you are echoing so bad. Why don't you call back in, man?
Okay.
I'm gonna mute you and call back in, buddy. Okay. Having a little bit of a tech problem there, but anyway, I just find that so cool. And what Phil was saying there was that you wouldn't want to project if it's some jerk you want to avoid. You certainly wouldn't want to project onto their shirt. Here's a jerk, run away.
No, you'd have to project something like. Dude, I have to take a phone call. I'll be back in a minute. Or would you like another drink? So you have the social escape.
Yeah. Phil, are you back?
I'm back. How am I sounding now?
You sound great.
Oh, much better.
Okay. Oh, good. All right. So I would just add to what I said since I didn't give a very good definition of lamina. If you want a great explanation of lamina, you should read Tobias Buckell's books. His novels, this technology is a huge part of that universe. So Crystal Rain, Ragamuffin, and the third one, Slime Mongoose, these wonderful space opera stories in which have this technology and use it. And I was thinking visually, the other great example that we have of lamina technology might be seeing the Terminator movies, where if you look at the world from the viewpoint of the Terminator, or even RoboCop, where he's seeing what's happening in the world, but there's also a digital display that's over that, where you're getting additional information. That's the basic idea.
Absolutely. I'm going to confess something that's probably the geekiest thing you'll ever learn about me, Phil. And this is saying something. This is going a ways.
Drum roll. Yeah.
Okay, here it is. The geekiest thing you may ever learn about Stephen Gordon. I am a excellent candidate for laser surgery, and I've never had it.
Uh-huh.
And there's a reason I've never had it, and it's related to this story. See if you can guess it.
Okay, so you're an excellent candidate, meaning that you have impaired vision.
I wear glasses, and I can't, you know, I mean, it's the first thing I reach for in the morning. It's the last thing I take off at night is my glasses. I need the glasses to function in the world. So, but I've been told surgery would give me 20/20, and I have not had it.
You won't. I'm assuming it's not because you're scared of games or anything like that. That wouldn't be geeky. That would just be sad, and then we'd feel sorry for you. So,
yeah, I would need the fear treatment from earlier this evening, but no, that's
exactly,
not.
Exactly. That's. But yeah. Okay. Gosh, I'm gonna have to. I give up. I don't know what. What is? Is it that you're expecting a better version down the road? So you want to hold off, or
no.
Robot eyes? You want to get? Oh, I know. You want to get a visor like Jordy has. That's what you're.
Well, that's closer. My thought is this, I was thinking about this 2 or 3 years ago, that there is going to come a time very soon where we have displays built into eyeglasses, and everybody's going to be wearing eyeglasses, and I'll be the jerk that had the surgery, and then 6 months later, I've got to put eyeglasses back on.
So, why bother with getting your laser eye surgery when you're just going to end up having to wear glasses anyway, because that's the likely interface for this lamina technology?
Exactly. That is the reason. So, that I consider that pretty dang geeky, and that's I thought I'd confess that since this story came up. But I guess I should
say that is... That is pretty far gone, but if that's the geekiest thing ever, you know, you're okay, really. That's pretty bad, but you know, you can keep co-host, though, that's for sure.
Okay, good. I haven't outed myself too bad.
No.
The reason, though, that this is cool, and I think could actually be, you know, sort of a precursor to the singularity is it's related to the old I Google is part of my brain idea. Okay. Google is part of my brain, but it's only part of my brain when I'm sitting down at a computer, okay? And
right.
Cell phones have made that better. I mean, you know, if you got an iPhone, you know, you got Google with you pretty much everywhere. But you can't pull out, you know, you can't pull out your cell phone necessarily, you know, when in the middle of a conversation with somebody and learn what, you know, without being completely rude. You can't pull out your cell phone, Google them while you're standing there and get the information and integrate it into the conversation. This would allow you, particularly if it's not being projected onto their shirt, instead it's just being projected on the back of your glasses, let's say, to get up to speed quick, you know, with maybe a very technical conversation or, you know, reminding yourself who the name of this person is that knows you so well, but you can't remember what their name is, things like that. It would make you functionally a smarter person. In many ways, you would be you could have greater than human level intelligence.
Yeah, at least greater than the level you had before, right? I mean,
it's
an enhancement for your intelligence, and I would so value that actually to be able to wear glasses and if nothing else, just that face recognition and put the name up there. So that I don't have to stumble for it. Because I'm one of these people that's like, by the time I get to the end of the hall, then I'm like, ah, it's Gary. You know, and you want to go back and go, Gary, right? But you don't actually do that.
You've lost the opportunity then, yeah.
Yeah, you know.
I'm real bad about that. I mean, I just don't keep up, you know. That's an important thing because using a person's name in conversation is huge at going towards breaking the ice. And so if you could remember that, it'd be great. That would be a great way to help with that small thing, you know. But it would be
that,
so
that alone. That alone would be a huge breakthrough. I think a huge breakthrough for us. Okay, well, we're going to move quickly on to our next. Oh, actually, let me just. This is Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network, and we're working our way through a list of breakthrough ideas. And the next one's from. Yours truly. I put up a blog post the other day. I called it, Here's a March on Washington They Wouldn't Expect. And bottom line, I'll make this one reasonably quick since probably anyone who reads Speculist has had a chance to see this, and it's awfully recent. But Glenn Reynolds had put a essay up on Forbes talking about longevity and talking about what he describes as the longevity dividend, the fact that people are living longer means that people can stay productive longer, potentially could stay productive longer, And if we can start capitalizing on technologies that are going to make it possible for people to have significantly longer, not just longer lives, but longer healthy lives, longer viable lives, this have a very positive impact socially and on the economy. I mean, we've talked about that before, how seasoned, mature, knowledgeable people acting in it, participating in the economy, participating in the business world, who are still physically capable of doing that, still mentally prepared to do that, would be a tremendous boost to the economy. Plus, you could avoid possible problems that we're going to see in the near future, hopefully not, but that we're likely to see with pensions and with Social Security and with a number of other structures that are put in place to deal with folks that are retired. So my suggestion is let's have a march on Washington. People around my age and older, or even a few years younger, I was really pleased to see somebody who's 12 years older than me say he was ready to go, and he called me a whippersnapper.
that becomes more and more cool to be called a whippersnapper the older you get, isn't it?
I know. Remember when you hated being called a kid? I love it so much when somebody calls me a kid. Oh, you're just a kid. I'm like, okay, fine, if you say so. So anyway, folks in the middle of life, and I said 40 and up, but we can define that term any way you want. March on Washington and demand that they raise. That's right, I said raise the retirement age. And at age 46, I'm saying I want them to raise the retirement age to 80. That's what I want to see happen. I don't know what it actually is on Social Security right now. Is it 66, 67? By the time I retire, I think it might be around there. But I'm saying, no, forget those 13 years. I want it to be 80. I want to work till I'm 80 at least. Actually, I want to work till I drop, as long as I'm doing something that I'm interested in. But what I want is I want for myself, I want for me as a worker to be a vital contributing worker that entire time. So me and all us folks who march on Washington, what we're saying is, yes, extend the retirement age, move it to 80, but that's going to come at a cost. And the cost is the government needs to put in place a serious program to fund longevity research. We would distribute the funding through a series of push prizes, and these would be aimed at achieving these really aggressive goals related to extending healthy life. And then I listed some possible examples of these. So I said, okay, for example, let's develop reliable preventative treatments for Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, and then boom, go ahead and retirement age up a couple of years. Some major breakthrough in preventing heart disease and diabetes, move it up a little bit further. Breakthroughs in preventing and treating cancer, move it up a little further. Breakthroughs in extending and enhancing cognitive ability amongst the aged, move it up some more. Breakthroughs in restoring and maintaining muscle and bone tissue, move it up some more. And actually, by the time you get all those in place, my thinking is you could probably move the retirement age to 100 or greater. But, you know, let's be realistic. Let's take it in small steps here, baby steps here. We move the retirement age to 80 based on our ability to achieve these other objectives. What do you think, Stephen?
Well, I liked what one of your commenters said. He mentioned that, you know, Social Security needs to be indexed to the our life expectancy, and I think that's going to be necessary. I think that if we're right at all about longevity and our abilities to extend lives, you know, if we're right even partially. And let's say we're wrong about a lot of things, but you know we're able to push average life expectancy up to age 90. You know the country is not going to be able to afford Social Security starting at age 66, 67 and a half, something like that. You know you can't have a large percentage of the population idle for 30 years. You can't have that. We wouldn't be able to afford it. So. I think at some point now, I mean, it wouldn't be a popular move, and few politicians are courageous enough to touch Social Security. But at some point, there would come a point when there would just it would have to be done.
Well, and this is why I'm talking about a march on Washington. It's a metaphorical march, but I think this is something that would almost have to originate as some kind of grassroots movement. Because per your point, and I think, Michael, you had sent an email to that effect too, you know, no politician is going to try to get himself elected on the, hey, let's raise the retirement age platform,
that's
right?
That's right.
You know, I remember a bit on Saturday Night Live years ago where the guy was withdrawing from a campaign, and he said, in retrospect, I guess my campaign slogan of let's raise property taxes sky high was not as well thought through as it should be. You know, it's just one of those, like, kind of non-starter ideas for a politician. No, it's I think the people would have to insist on it and then draft a politician for something like that.
You know, Harvey's idea is even better. Instead of Social Security benefits indexed throughout the population to, what life expectancy is for everybody, index it individually to your Wii Fit age, you know.
There you go.
The Wii Fitness age. So I think that's hilarious and actually not a bad idea.
That's a great idea, and it goes to that idea we talked about a couple weeks ago about a person's credit score eventually maybe being something that's determined by their ranking on Facebook or LinkedIn or some other social network. Just the idea that, yeah, this information will all be available online and well in hand for the robot overlords when they finally make their move. Yeah, I think that's a great suggestion. Okay, well, we're running short on time, so Michael, I think you've got one more breakthrough for us.
Yeah, and I can be a lot quicker with this one because I don't really understand the biology. Although I did want to say that the more I think about it, the more I really like the semantic web from last week. But since that's not one for this week, let me say this. Reprogramming cells. And it sounds like this isn't the breakthrough because it sounds like this is something that happened a couple of years ago when we got induced pluripotent stem cells. But the guys who claim to have invented induced pluripotent stem cells hadn't really accomplished in the lab or in a repeatable way what we all kind of hoped and thought they had. But in 2008, just weeks ago, really, not only the pluripotent stem cell, but the way to reprogram that cell so it could become another cell, that can be done. That is real. It's not real for humans yet, but it's close. They can do it in mice. They can do it in some other creatures. And that to me seems and feels big, although, like I said, I don't totally understand the biology.
But when you talk about reprogramming cells, are you talking about taking mature cells and turning them back into cells, or are you talking about something beyond that? I just
quoting Science Magazine. Quoting Science Magazine, researchers took skin cells, human skin cells, from patients suffering a wide variety of diseases and reprogrammed those cells into stem cells. The transformed cells grew and divided in the laboratory, giving researchers new tools to study the cellular process that underlie the patient's disease. The achievement was also important. Or is seen to be an important step on a long path to treating disease with the patient's own cells. And then they talk about how this is what they can do in mice. They can take these cells and do this, or they can take these cells and do that. It's, like I said, the biology of what actually they're doing, I don't quite get, but that kind of breakthrough to say, hey, we're going to take skin cells from this guy who's got fill in the blank with disease X, and we're going to turn those cells into something that allows us to study the disease in that person, that seems huge.
Well, what's great about that idea is just that the stem cells that you get are a perfect genetic match for the receiving the treatment.
That's right.
In fact, I think we had listed that one as in our top scientific stories for 2008. I think that was in our ranking, somebody's ranking. I remember seeing it. That was the number one story of the year. That was huge. That had occurred. And they're making significant progress with the process since then in terms of – one of the big problems right now is you do get these pluripotent cells. You do get these stem cells that can then be used to treat the individual, but they're not entirely stable. Somebody had left a comment when I wrote about this last week that they tend to go cancerous and other problems. So there's a long way to go with this. But if you want to draw some lines between some of the other ideas, I would think – that this ability to take mature cells and reset the clock on them, turn some of those back into pluripotent stem cells, is going to be one of the biggest contributors to healthy life extension. If you go back, relatively soon,
I would think.
If you're into that kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, if you like that sort of thing.
Being young, yeah, I'm into that.
Just out of that list that I gave, you think about treating, curing Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. I'm sure that there's an application from this to that. When you talk about being able to restore muscular development, bone density, those kinds of things, you know, that all fits right into there. So I think that if we want to reset the retirement age, Michael, your breakthrough is going to be one of those that we're going to need.
Right.
Okay. So we've zipped through. How many have we done so far? Five breakthroughs,
yeah.
And I've got one more, and we've got 5 minutes. And I was actually inclined to say that if I tried to take this one on, I'd probably need about half a show. So what the heck? I'm going to give it a shot anyway with 5 minutes. This one connects, Michael, to Yuria about the nature and the scope of the revolution that occurred with the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. And my suggestion is this, my breakthrough is this. We need to adopt as a society, as a country, an approach to solving problem solving that is less ideological based and more evolutionary. And my thinking on this is that this draws out of having read a lot of John Smart's stuff and the evolution / development model of how we came to be and how life on this planet has come to be, and which actually can be applied also to the progress that we've made as a society. One of the things that Evo Devo folks talk about, evolution development folks talk about, is these biological optima, they call it, reaching the best solution, the best possible solution to a problem. And arguably, any species within its particular niche, evolutionarily speaking, is kind of the optima for that niche. And one of the things that John Smart has talked about is, well, and would these optima apply to other planets? So, or would they have applied to other evolutionary cycles? So if humans hadn't become the dominant species on this Earth, would it have been a bipedal dinosaur, right, that maybe had a shot at that? And we've looked at those pictures and talked about that. Maybe the biped form is the optimal form for achieving the kind of technological civilization that we have. So there's this idea of the optimum choice, the idea of the best possible state that you can move to. And what's interesting is our political process is driven by ideologies, and the two major ones that we have compete with each other on a government program is the solution to all problems versus eliminating government programs is the solution to all problems. Or, they might state it as a private free enterprise solution is the solution to all problems. And yet we know, and Michael, this is something that you had suggested in comments you had left in one of the posts, I think it was Better All the Time I wrote a few weeks back, that there are times when the government solution is almost certainly the optimum solution. And I would list things like the United States Marine Corps, right? Hardly anyone is going to seriously argue that we need to come up with some like private replacement for that. And I think one of the examples given was the inner system. Yeah, those are the optimum choices. Government implemented makes sense. And then you look on the other side and you go, well, there are definitely some things that the optimum has got to be the free market, the individual market decision, such as my career choice. If I decide I want to work for this company, I want to do this job, you know, the government should have no role in that whatsoever, or where I live, or those kinds of things. So there's two extremes and we can say, yep, we know that there's an optimum. There are definitely things that it only makes sense for government to do. There are definitely things that only make sense for the private individual to do. And then we've got these two ideologies that always try to co-opt everything else in the middle, saying, well, whatever else I know that all the rest of the stuff needs to be private, or whatever else I know, all the rest of this stuff needs to be government run. What if we could put those ideologies aside and come up with the criteria that we would need to start saying, you know what, for public school, or for education generally, for healthcare, for the financial system, for the environment, we're going to define the best state, the state that we as a society would all agree on. And then we're going to look at different models of how we would get to that particular state, rather than, whatever happens, we don't need another government department, or whatever happens, we don't need these greedy business people driving us even further into ruin. So that's my very quickly stated suggestion, that we replace ideology with an evolutionary model, and we start working towards the optimum choice, the optimum solution in all these different regions that we know are still problems, but we haven't come up with a solution for yet.
You know, number one, Phil, I think that's brilliant. Would you suggest, simulating that? I mean, having basically a very involved, very advanced a Sims program or something, where you try different solutions to various problems and see what works best.
I hadn't thought about it, but as you mentioned it, some kind of at least advanced algorithms, if not simulation, would almost certainly be required. I think you would want to run as realistic simulations as you possibly could, and develop models as close to what you think is going to happen for different approaches to come up with the best one. Absolutely.
It strikes me that you have to be careful as to the model builders, that ideology doesn't creep in. In one of the first versions of SimCity, if you didn't put churches in place, you got hit by storms more often. because you weren't allowing your Sims to pray to keep the storms away. So obviously that was built into the idea that prayer can change reality was built in. And so you need to be careful to make sure that ideology at least is vetted. If I've got this idea that this makes this work, then it needs to be out in the open, not buried within the code where nobody knows, well, why is the sim coming out this way, simulation coming out this way. It needs to be discussed as to what ideologies and ideas go into building the models. But yeah, I think that's a great idea.
You're right. That would have to be a variable, and it would have to be tunable then. And you could say, okay, well, you've assumed your ideology. Now let's reset that number to this, and let's reset it here. And I think we can all agree that it's somewhere between these two, right? As long as it's visible and people see it. On the other hand, the one thing you would almost certainly have to simulate within the simulation is just the fact that people do have these biases, that they do have these ideologies. I'm not... dreamer enough to think that we're going to completely eliminate people having political ideology. I don't think that's going to go anywhere. But if, in addition to that, we had this model, if we could subjugate ideology just a little bit to put a different spin on it, I think it could make a tremendous difference. Well, we've run about 3 minutes over, but since we're over anyway, I don't want to rush the end. I'm going to just check in with you real fast, Michael, and see, is there any breakthrough ideas from our friends in the chat room?
Harvey thinks that we need to get back to a world where households can make it on one income. I couldn't agree with him more.
Yeah, I agree, too. And it needs to be a big, fat income, too.
Hey, we had somebody earlier in the chat room that was taking Phil to task over his bias against chemically conquering our fears. Phil, are you going Tom Cruise on us? What's the problem here?
Oh, no. I meant for society. Okay, I think as individuals, it's probably going to be a matter of choice. I guess talking from a social level, and if this individual, I doubt, means that, but if they're saying, hey, we need to be adding fear inhibitors to the water or to the air supply or something like that, that's really what I was trying to say. So I as a species, as a collective, I don't want to see us taking fear inhibitors or having, worse yet, having them forced on us. But individual choices, people trying to work through their fears in their own lives, I think that's it's up to them as individuals. And no, I'm not going Tom Cruise.
Okay, fair enough.
Thanks for the question. I do like the question. Okay, anything else from the chat room? All right, well, Stephen, what have we got going on music-wise this evening?
The music tonight is, the song is Razor Eyes, and the band is Elevation.
All right, we'll be listening to Elevation by Razor Eyes. Stephen, thank you so much for your contributions, Michael Breakthroughs, for everyone listening live and for everyone listening to us on recording. We appreciate you being with us on Fast Forward Radio, and we look forward to being with you the next time. Until then, live to see it.